I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source with Tale Tellers About Russia and why the old bear is giving the U.S. fits again over Ukraine and the Crimea. Here were some short takes today from some Russian emigres in a Brookline bookstore.
They try to understand the situation in Ukraine, but they just don't understand. That's what's going on with the United States. It's like, for example, if something happens in southern Texas with Mexico, for example, and the United States wants, for example, Russia to decide what to do with them, right? It's not clear enough for Russians to understand what's going on between southern Texas, Mexico, and the United States. Too far away. And it's not our history.
I've never been a big supporter of President Putin. I mean, I believe some of the things that he's done are rather questionable, but it's a special situation. It's like 95% of that region are Russian or have some sort of Russian roots. It's not surprising that majority of them do want to live in Russia. And in that sense, Putin does represent what people want to do.
We're talking about Russia. We start with Suzanne Massey, who so beguiled and enchanted Ronald Reagan with earthy tales of her ordinary Russian friends that the President of the United States brought her back for 20 visits at the White House and ended up doing the unthinkable, walking through Red Square in Moscow and calling off the old Cold War. Mark Kramer is also here from Harvard, lifelong student of Russian politics, and then two Russian-born scholars, Svetlana Boym and Maxim Schreier, both intimately acquainted with the greatest of Russian tale-tellers going back to Chekhov, Dostoevsky, and Tolstoy, and the foundations of this crisis, as it's called, around Russia's rough-and-ready claim on the wheat fields of Ukraine and the resort peninsula of the Crimea in the Black Sea. Listeners, is it really a crisis, or perhaps an outbreak of Cold War nostalgia on both sides? Our phone is 800-423-8255. And then what I'm most eager to hear this hour, what do the ancestral geniuses of Russian fiction and all the world's wisdom, what would they be telling us and their countrymen about what's going on? Right up to Solzhenitsyn and Nabokov and beyond. What do the novelists want to tell us? 800-423-8255 is our phone. First, Suzanne Massey, please put this in context. 30 years ago, you almost literally barged into the White House and the Oval Office and turned President Reagan's thinking around. An almost unbelievable story that you recount in a citizen's memoir called Trust But Verify, Reagan, Russia, and Me. If you could get back into the Oval Office this spring, Suzanne Massey, what would you be telling President Obama about what the Russians and we are going through here?
Well, hello.
Welcome back, Suzanne.
It's very nice to talk to you again. That's a difficult question. Let me just say that I think my first reaction would have been to say my favorite proverb, which is when in doubt, hesitate. I do not think that we should have acted so precipitously. And I would say that right now, if we can, although it's a little late, we ought to back off any interest. We really don't have the right to interfere in that very delicate region. I don't know why we didn't understand how delicate and how raw a nerve that was for Russia to have us be involved in Ukraine.
You've said so many times, Suzanne Massey, that we always get it wrong on Russia. Going how far back and why?
Well, I just gave a speech on that called Why Are We Always Wrong About Russia? And I have to say that we started at that already at the beginning of the 20th century. That's when it's been the worst, because in the 19th century we were great friends and, in fact, idolized Alexander II, who had freed the serfs 3 years before Lincoln freed the slaves, and that we were very grateful to Russia for coming to the aid of the Union. In fact, we had the greatest friendship. This changed at about the beginning of the century and after the Russian Revolution, most specifically. And there are many reasons for this. I don't want to go on about it, but I think grew up a whole bunch of stereotypes which have never left. And it's very, you can easily well, if you look from whether when they were good, that was with good old Uncle Joe Stalin, how wrong we were about that. And then when they were all bad, we were wrong about that. And we've been wrong ever since, and made the wrong judgments. Even President Bush, just a few weeks before the Soviet Union collapsed like a bad souffle, was out there in Kiev giving a speech recommending the permanence and legitimacy of the Soviet Union. That's a good example, and I think this is a new example of not understanding.
What were the magic words you spoke to Ronald Reagan that registered immediately with him? Maybe were on his mind all the time.
Well, all I can say is that I found that Ronald Reagan was a people person. He was interested not in what the Soviets said, but what were the Russians like. Hmm. And he was quite correct about that, since we had made them a synonym, and they were very different. Russian people normally called their government them and themselves us. So there was a great difference there. And that was one of the key things, I think, that he really took up on and understood very well. And the other, and perhaps that was the most important thing, I told him, and I was amazed that no one had told the American president before, that the Russians were religious, that they had a religion that had lasted 1,000 years, and despite the persecution of their government, that somehow it managed to survive. And now it's come back so big that 2/3 of the Russian people now say that they're Orthodox.
What's the history to learn from about the Ukraine specifically, and generally, how's to reconcile the differences in the Ukraine between their Russianness and also their Ukrainian nationalism, and around Kiev, certainly, a sense of their Europeanness?
Well, Kiev is, of course, the birthplace of Russian civilization. It was called Kiev Rus. That's where their name comes from. And from the 9th to the 12th century, it was a thriving kingdom. And the Russians consider it the cradle of Russian civilization and the Orthodox religion. So, and in fact, they existed for 200 years. They were a very developed civilization until they were annihilated by the Mongol invasions in 1240 and absolutely were destroyed completely. But the Russians still regard it as their, if you want, spiritual capital. That's one reason. And, of course, Ukraine was never anything, excuse me, but a part of Russia, an intimate part of Russia, until 1991, when for the first time it became an independent state. It was always an intimate part of Russia, connected with Russia. I'm sure you'll hear this when you talk with writers. And in fact, right now, they can't seem to get together. It's a terrible thing, but it is perhaps a state now, but it is an independent state now, but it is not a nation. It has great contradictions in religion. East is Orthodox, West is more Catholic, ethnic differences, language differences, and they have never been able to find a leader, so far anyway, that is able to unify the two sides.
So then, what is the Crimea?
Crimea is a different thing. The Crimea is the home and the legal home, because they have an agreement with Ukraine since 1991. They have a lease on all of these enormous bases. It is, to give it a comparison, it's like San Diego. It is a critical, absolutely critical place for national security for the Russians. And it is, for them, key to their national security.
You tell an important story in your book, Trust But Verify, that I'm sure it extends to this day, but it's about Reagan and Gorbachev at Reykjavik, when the men together, as men, fathers, friends by then, truly wanted to get rid of the nuclear arsenals. Their staffs, not to mention the huge military bureaucracies that they both had back home, but even their personal staffs undermined them. We're not going to let them do it. What is this about the people in the way? Sometimes I think the media is in the way, too, of a much, much better relationship between us and them.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that that's one of the problems that has existed in our country for the last 2 years, almost since the Cold War. We seem to sort of been continuing the Cold War in the pages of the press. And I find the press really very, very poor in their reporting. That's one thing. As far as the two wonderful leaders, and they both were wonderful leaders, they absolutely, both of them, were very anxious to get rid of nuclear weapons. The Soviet Union at Reykjavik did make a proposal of cutting all their forces 50%. They wanted it very much. It is true that it is their entourage, if you want, that held it up. And they were both heartbroken by this. Reagan, I think it's the greatest disappointment of his entire probably life, because that is something he wanted above all things. And he told me that not once, but several times. When I asked him, what did he want from the Russians? He said, I want to get rid of those atomic weapons, every one. However, his defense establishment and bureaucrats did not agree. They were, of course, very loath to give up American, if you want, hegemony in terms of military hegemony. And I know for a fact that what they did was to kind of, you know, put bars in the wheels and really were afraid that Reagan would go further than they wanted to go. That's one. And on the other side, the Soviets had their group who did also try to stop it. And that's what happened at Reykjavik. Both sides had people putting bars in the wheels. But in the end, the Soviets were much closer to us, had come around to believe what Reagan had promised, and that was to share everything.
Suzanne Massey's breakthrough book on Russia years ago was Land of the Firebird, The Beauty of Old Russia. Her new one is Trust But Verify, Reagan, Russia, and Me, the story of how one American woman from Maine helped end the Cold War. You can hear a lot more of our conversation with Suzanne Massey on our website, radioopensource.org. We're looking into this quick chill in American-Russian relations. Not a Cold War yet, though President Obama today upped the sanctions for President Putin's moves on Ukraine and the Crimea. 800-423-8255 is our phone. Here's a question. Is Putin the problem, or is it something else? Mark Kramer is the all-purpose history and politics man at Harvard's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. What's your line, Mark Kramer? Putin or something deeper?
I do see Putin as the real source of the problem. In fact, I make a distinction between Putin and Russia. Often in the conversation now, you do hear Russian policy, Russia's actions. And of course, Russia is the country, but Putin is really the one whose policies these are. In the 1990s, when Russia was under Boris Yeltsin, the first post-Soviet president, things were certainly not perfect. There was a great deal that went on in Russia during that time that was really at odds with Western norms and values. But still, Russia seemed to be moving toward a more democratic system. But ever since Putin came in 2000, Russia has reverted to a more authoritarian system. And now, more recently, has also been pursuing a more aggressive foreign policy. And that was reflected in the effort to take advantage of the political vacuum that opened in Ukraine.
Mark, we know he's not a nice guy, and he may be a kleptocrat, too. But what do you make of the huge resonance in his own popularity that these moves seem to have? And furthermore, what do you make of a national leader saying, almost bleeding in public, saying we've been humiliated, and getting a positive response from that too?
Well, what's been interesting is to see how Putin has moved public opinion. In early January, there was a poll taken by the Levada Center showing that about 75% of Russians were opposed to getting involved in Ukraine. That was early February. Now, the latest polls have shown that about 85% of Russians support what Putin has done. So it's a complete turnaround that Putin was able to move public opinion in his favor. But there's no question he is a popular leader in Russia. The latest favorability rating show that it's about 72%, which any Western leader would really die for.
The thought jumped right out of my head, but on the Putin matter, I'm still puzzled about his purpose. I'm puzzled about his fear. Does the difficulty in the Ukraine since the revolution there, is that a menace to him?
It certainly was.
No, but is it a menace today? Is it part of his aggressive?
He sees it that way. It's 10 years now since the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. That was in December of 2004. The Orange Revolution in November 2004 was targeted against blatant electoral fraud. The candidate that Putin had supported in Ukraine, Yanukovych, was being pushed to become president then in what was a clearly fraudulent election. The Orange Revolution overturned that, and that was the first thing that really caused Putin to become alarmed, a fear that the same thing might happen in Russia. But the latest events, what began last November in 2013 and then culminated in February 2014 with the ouster of Yanukovych, who was elected in a free election in 2010 and was the president. But that is what particularly alarmed Putin. He himself had confronted protests in late 2011 and early 2012 when he was about to return as president. And they had briefly caught him off guard, but they certainly did not prevent his election. But what he is really worried about now is that the example that has been set in Ukraine is something that some Russians might aspire to emulate.
I want to ask you, but I'd love to get Suzanne Massey's opinion, too, about the NATO piece of this whole story. NATO would make me nervous if they were advancing on my neighborhood as fast as they're approaching Putin's. What is the purpose of all that, and how much does that explain his sense of being beleaguered?
NATO did gradually enlarge, starting in the late 1990s and continuing through in recent years. I happen to think it was done in a way that was needlessly seen as being directed against Russia. It could have been done in a much more inclusive way to try to hold out the prospect that Russia, too, could someday become a member. So I'm not one to defend the way NATO enlargement was done. And it is part of the context here. It's something that many Russians resent, not just Putin. But still, I think it would be simplistic to argue, as, say, Jack Matlock did in a recent article in the Washington Post, that NATO enlargement really is driving this, that this is the thing that has been a backlash against the West. And I see that as much too monocausal an explanation of Putin's actions here. It's a part of the context, but it's only one thing. This was really driven more, I think, by Putin's domestic interests and particularly his concern that this might set a precedent for Russia.
And yet this story never dies, that George H.W. Bush, in effect, promised Moscow at the time of the unification of Germany that if the Russians gave up took their mitts entirely off East Germany, NATO would never move an inch toward Moscow.
Well, there was certainly no formal commitment at any time, neither in writing nor in speaking. However, thinking of the larger context, there's no doubt that at a time when the Cold War had ended and the Warsaw Pact was then disbanded in mid-1991, that many Soviet officials, not just Gorbachev, expected that NATO would either go out of business itself or would drastically reconfigure itself. No one really expected that NATO, in fact, would do the opposite, would enlarge. So there was no formal promise, no formal commitment, but there was an underlying expectation, I think, on the part of Soviet / Russian officials.
Did it go further than that, Suzanne Massey?
Well, I must agree with Mark, whom I respect very much, on this point, but I would make it, I think I differ with Mark on one point. I think it's more important to Putin and to Russians than simply Putin's domestic situation. He is, after all, very popular and has remained very popular, and his present actions have made him even more popular. So I don't agree that that's the I think that I would say that NATO is the overriding one of all of these various things, of which there are many, and that this relentless push of NATO, I think we spent, Mark, you would know better than me, but something like $700 billion to enlarge NATO, I do think, and I've heard the Russians say that, what we dissolved the Warsaw Pact. What is NATO against? What are they fighting? Why is it enlarging? I agree with Mark. We should have found a way, I think, to bring the Russians in, if that would make it more sensible. Then it would be a whole big organization to defend the Eurasian continent, which I think is more important today than ever. And I would say that was one of the key reasons for this. But the other is that I feel very strongly about this, that we should never, ever in the United States have taken sides in this very complicated muddle of things in Ukraine, that we acted much too fast and I think intemperately. I am Swiss. My attitude toward things like this was, when in doubt, hesitate. And we were definitely in doubt. And we did not know what we were getting in the first place. And I'm not sure that it was a great thing in the first place. And
Suzanne,
doesn't seem it does. So I think that the fact that we let us say, I would consider it a premature choosing of sides without taking in any at all the obvious interest and even, well, I would say, I can't even say how important to the Russians it would be without even really considering them, and then, you know, throwing oil on the fire or gasoline on the fire by even talking about bringing Ukraine into NATO.
Suzanne, hold it there for a moment. Our phone is 800-423-8255. I love the notion, and it's been around a while informally, that, you know, Russia ought to be in NATO, and maybe that's the question for listeners. Why can't we get out of a Cold War framework in our relations with the Russians? But Suzanne, I want to draw you out on this guy, Putin. You may be you're the only woman I know who's been embraced by and probably kissed on both cheeks by Ronald Reagan and Vladimir Putin. what's the difference?
And who, I wouldn't have thought of myself that way.
That will be on your tombstone.
Talk about Putin, the man. And you saw him not so long ago in a public ceremony, and he walked halfway across the stadium to greet you.
Well, I can't say I know Putin well, but remember I spent a great deal of time in Leningrad. Leningrad is a very small city, really, and you knew pretty much everybody, and I knew Anatoly Sobchak very well, and he was a deputy mayor. That is, Putin was. So I knew him there. I can't say he never kissed me there. But anyway, I saw him when Sobchak had fallen, you know, had lost the election, and I happened to run into him in a hotel in Moscow, and I asked him what he was going to do. He said he was going to go work in the administrative office of the president. And then I saw him again in the year 2000, in a very important time, in the church, the reconstructed Church of the Savior, which holds 12,000 people, and this was the first Christmas liturgy. And the altar there is as big as a football field. So he had just become president. I sort of thought, well, gee, I know him. I just would like to wave. And then I thought, that's not appropriate. So I sent an acolyte over to tell him where I was. And yes, indeed, he did walk across the entire altar and gave me the traditional Russian three kisses that you do, you know, for holidays and everything else. And so
just two in Hollywood, but three in St.
Three
Petersburg.
In Russia, because God loves three, say the Russians. In any case, I was quite taken back. I found it possible to burble out, I congratulate you. But basically, I wondered why he had done it. I say, and I think this has a lot to do with today. I think he is an emotional man, despite those cold blue eyes that everybody talks about, that he's very emotional. I think he's behaving very emotionally now. And words like humiliate and betray are emotional words. I think that he's not cold. He's a Russian. Russians often behave emotionally, and when it has to do with their history, very emotionally. And I really took that action on his part, because there was no other American there. No ambassadors, no nothing. It was a church full of Russians, as far as I know. And I think I took it as a gesture, a goodwill gesture toward the United States. And I still believe that's what it was.
I want to say again, I take a man seriously when he's an emotional person speaks, and he's the leader of a state, about humiliation and betrayal.
So would I.
This is either very scary or he's trying to tell us something very intimate about where he's really at.
I believe that. I do think that's a very strong word. It's a very strong word in Russian. And betrayal is the same.
Yeah.
And I that's why I felt this to be very serious and very sad. I found myself wondering, I mean, clearly we have destroyed that beginning and wonderfully developing trust that had developed between Gorbachev and Reagan. And you know, without any trust, you can't have any verify, and you can't have any talks. You have to be able to trust the other side. And clearly, that's been lost now.
Let me just say, though, I found a remarkable degree of hypocrisy in Putin's speech, though, as well. I don't deny that some of those sentiments are genuine. In fact, I think many of them are. But look at the actions he's taking now are humiliating Ukrainians, which is precisely, in part, I think, what his intention is, to humiliate Ukraine, to make it clear to them that they are subordinate to Russians, and that Russia has the right to dismember Ukraine if it wishes. In addition, though, you know, up until recently, most Ukrainians had looked favorably on Russia. That will never be the case, at least for a long time to come. Again, you know, Ukrainians will look on Russia as an enemy from now on. And then Putin talks about the need for Crimeans to have the right to self-determination. Well, what about the Chechens then? Is there going to be a referendum in Chechnya, which where there's probably even greater sentiment for independence? I mean, there was a real element of hypocrisy in what he had to say.
Mark, I wish you'd...
Go ahead, Suzanne. I don't want to interrupt you, Mark, but there's a hell of a lot of hypocrisy in our statements.
I fully agree with you. And in fact, I agree with you too, Suzanne, on Ukraine. I mean, I was uneasy about a lot of what went on in Ukraine, and I thought that Western countries were much too quick to latch on to it. So I'm not disagreeing there either. I don't think, though, that any of that, no matter what occurred there and some of the dubious qualities of it, that it justified Russia's dismemberment of part of Ukraine, you know, that is seizing Crimea.
Mark, I want to...
Excuse me, but I do disagree. I believe, see, I think Crimea does belong to Russia because Khrushchev had no business giving it away just like that, just before he went to lunch or on the way to lunch, without asking anybody in the Crimea whether they wanted it or not.
But much the same could be said about some of the components of Russia, including Chechnya. You know, why should it be part of Russia? I mean,
you're right. I agree with you.
Again, if you begin, it's not to deny. I mean, again, Crimea historically is Russia. Culturally, it is heavily Russian. But still, you know, if you begin to go down that path, it becomes a very delicate issue for Russia itself.
I want to move ahead on Putin's moves here. I mean, the leader of the Slavic nation is also making this kind of pivot toward what he calls the Eurasian Union. Decode that, Mark Kramer.
The Eurasian Union is designed to recreate something like a Soviet Union light. It would not be the Soviet Union, but it had none of the ideological trapping. But the idea is to, at least on an economic level and to some extent politically, to bind the Slavic components and some Central Asian components of what was formerly the Soviet Union. Without Ukraine, it's far less meaningful than it would be. And Putin's major goal was to try to have the Ukrainians enter. But that didn't happen under Yanukovych, and it certainly is not going to happen now.
But just who is he talking about in this union?
Well,
who are the real Asian players in it?
Currently, Kazakhstan is a member. Others have at various points indicated the possibility, Kyrgyzstan in particular. But currently, Belarus would be the other major component. So it would be Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus.
On all these Russian questions, we've got genius writers to call on for ideas and inspiration. Tolstoy, Chekhov, Nabokov, Dostoevsky, Joseph Brodsky in our time. Listeners, who would you summon from the Russian pantheon to unfold what's going on? 800-423-8255. Maxim Schreier joins us in the studio. He teaches Russian, English, and Jewish studies at Boston College. His breakthrough book was Leaving Russia, A Jewish Story. His new one is Waiting for America. Pick a writer and interview him for us, Maxim.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be here. And, I know that you're keen to talk about Chekhov, and there is a big Crimean connection. As you know, Chekhov moved permanently to Crimea in 1898 and lived there until his death.
He wrote his most famous story about the lady with the dog.
Absolutely, and he pined after Olga Kniper-Chekhova, who was in Moscow, and he did also write two major plays there and about 10 major stories. And it's on the Yalta embankment that Gurov meets Anna. Here's what I think, and this in part references what's been said on this show, but also a few things that have not been said. And I just want to say, with all due respect to Suzanne Massey, whose books I read and admire, especially her anthology, Living Mirror, I think hers is a very Russocentric view of history. I doubt very much Chekhov would subscribe to this very Russocentric view of history and of Crimea in particular. I think Chekhov, as a humanist, as a doctor and an author, would profess the following. I think he would say that it is cruel to abuse the weak and to steal from the poor. And I think the intervention in Crimea is abuse of the weak and stealing from the poor. I also think Chekhov would take a much longer view of Crimean history, which at the moment, as the Russian mainstream is portraying, Crimea as being Russian does not go beyond the end of the 18th century. But of course, Crimean history goes far beyond the end of the 18th century when Russia annexed it, and far back into classical antiquity. Crimea is layered with history, with different languages, cultures, and religions, and it's soaked with blood of different people who fought to defend it and to conquer it. I think to take the view of Russia's very special claim to Crimea is to overlook a whole lot. And I think Chekhov and Tolstoy, to turn to Tolstoy, would call on us to have a lot more memory and a lot more understanding of and sensitivity to the other.
I take your sense that Chekhov, he surely would not want a national, international border between his house in the Crimea and his house in Moscow, but he would have been an awful lot nicer than Mr. Putin about, making that claim. Chekhov is one thing. Dostoevsky is another, very much on my mind, because he was a Slavic nationalist who abhorred the West in so many ways that Putin is resonating with some piece of Dostoevsky there. One of maybe my favorite Dostoevsky novel is Demons, which was really a picture of Russia beset by all these demons of the West, including nihilism and socialism and all these other things. He felt that Russian Orthodoxy was the true faith and all that sort of thing. What would he be saying about this kind of too rude expression of these Russian nationalist views?
Well, first of all, Chris, you're correct, but Dostoevsky said different things in different places, and especially when he started wearing the mantle of the prophet, he started saying things in such a way that they acquired this kind of prophetic Russian national resonance. I think in other places, Dostoevsky is a lot more sensitive to the plight of minorities, to the plight of non-Russians, including Ukrainians, Poles, Jews, and I still think that Dostoevsky, the genius of art, as opposed to Dostoevsky, the sometimes crazy polemicist, would not be too keen on what's happening today in Crimea.
And how about Tolstoy?
Oh, I think Tolstoy is a particularly attractive story. Tolstoy became a writer in Sebastopol. Tolstoy came to Crimea in 1854-55, as he said to his brother, to out of patriotic feelings. And this is, by the way, at least when we should be thinking of historical parallels. In the Crimean War, remember, Russia was being battled by the Ottoman Empire, the Brits, the French, and Sardinia as well, all for control of the Black Sea. And it's at Sebastopol that Tolstoy observed all this and wrote his first great works, the Three Sebastopol Stories. He really, one could say, became a writer as Crimea was being fought for and the Black Sea was being fought for. And he kept returning to Crimea with mixed feelings, incidentally. And as you know, in 1901-02, he lay there on Countess Panina's estate outside of Yalta in Gospra, recovering from a long illness, and had this beautiful room where he had a view of the sea, and that's where Chekhov came to see him a number of times, himself very ill. Tolstoy would have been extremely unhappy, and I'm almost
unhappy
sure
about
of
what?
This. About the annexation of Crimea.
Would he have voted no?
Listen, he wrote Haji Murat in Crimea as he was recuperating from that illness. And Haji Murat is one of the greatest Russian literary works about the sense of what it feels like when the empire annexes other groups, other territories to which it has no historical claim whatsoever, and in this case, North Caucasus. Tolstoy, I think, would have been horrified, despite the fact that he probably had a certain affinity with the Crimea as a place, and also because Russian blood was shed there, but not the annexation, not the intervention.
Svetlana Boym joins us by phone. She's professor of Slavic and comparative literatures at Harvard and the author of Another Freedom, A Reflection on Freedom Across Cultures. Svetlana, read the masters for us.
Hi, Chris. Hi,
welcome.
Maxim. I would like to say that in Russia, there was a saying that writer in Russia is kind of like a second government, an unofficial legislator of the people.
Solzhenitsyn's
so I very
slogan.
Much agree that one should not think of the unity between Russians and the Russian state. And in a way, Russian literature was a kind of a place for dialogues and also for dissent. I think it was Brodsky who echoed Gogol and said that writer has to be a little bit of a foreigner in its own land. So I think if we look at Russian literature, we will find many interesting dissenting ideas. And I was struck by the line in Putin's emotional speech, in my view, quite dangerously emotional, when he spoke about domestic traitors and a certain kind of fifth column that emerged in Russia, which sympathizes with the West. And I thought that it was direct reference to the civil society, to all these people who protested against his elections since 2011. And one could say that to some extent, Russian culture was defined Russian identity, but also was a kind of fifth column, the place of dissent. So if I may give you a very famous quote from the poem by Tuchev, which actually was repeated by Putin, ironically paraphrased and misquoted. And the quote goes like that. I'm sure Maxim knows it. You cannot grasp Russia with your mind or judge her by any common measure. Russia is one of a special kind. You can only believe in her. Умом Россию не понять. And it ends with, в Россию можно только верить. The last lines is, you may only believe in Russia, and Putin paraphrased it, saying you should only believe in Russia. But I just want to say that these lines were endlessly parodied, made fun of through the Russian culture, including a contemporary poet who said it's time to understand Russia with our mind and not to exoticize the Russian soul, for example, which was an invention of foreign travelers to Russia. So I think one has to remember that it's still a divided country in spite of a huge support for Putin. I know many Russian friends, and I speak in their name here, who supported the Euromaidan, who speak about the suppression of media in Russia. So I think it is also dangerous to invoke the fear of Cold War and not to support, not to express solidarity with this kind of internally divided Russia. And, of course, Russian literature is one of those places where we can see it.
Yeah. Svetlana, I want to come back to your friends in Russia today, but Maxim, do you want to respond?
Well, just I agree largely with what Svetlana is saying, although Tucher's poem is very problematic in and of itself, in the sense that I think, going back to what I was saying earlier about this Russocentric view of history, of course, in respecting Russia, we should also not disrespect Ukraine. In admiring Russian culture, we should also not put down Ukrainian culture, but also Ukrainian nationhood and identity. I think some of the things were said earlier, not sitting well with me about Ukraine not having a national tradition or culture or statehood. This is nonsense. And I think what we need is a balanced view. That kind of balanced view comes largely from learning, not just from the classics, but also from the pattern of history that is very easy to identify. I think the Crimean intervention demonstrates that a nation stays true to its historical legacy. And in that sense, is it a shock that Russia annexed Crimea? No. But I also think that Russia's historical claim is tenuous and very short-sighted, and that a lot of what's happening in the rhetoric of the annexation is in this play, in Putin's play, in Russia's play, is that the notions of Russian cultural patrimony and Russian identity and orthodoxy are being crudely manipulated. And I think it's very important to acknowledge that.
Svetlana, I want to give you time to, if you will, sort of imagine our way into a cafe in Petersburg and tell us what those Dostoevskian sort of underground men who will be read as prophets someday, what are they saying about what Russia's going through right now? The bluff, the bluster, the difficulty around Putin.
Well, first of all, I want to respond to Maxim that I'm very much in agreement with him. And I think Russian patrimony is now being redefined. We see that many writers, like, for example, Gogol, were Ukrainian and very much indebted to Ukrainian culture. So I think what we do now in humanities is really rethink the canon and rethink what was considered to be unified Russian heritage. So seeing Ukrainian, seeing multicultural tradition. But now to the cafe and the underground men. I have a vague feeling that underground men might be turning pro-Putin, but luckily not on underground men. Actually did not like to go to the cafe, as we remember. I think the people who would be sitting in St. Petersburg cafe might be the people who went to the protests. I think there would be a disagreement and great division, and it's the disagreements that we don't hear very much in the press. I'm always troubled when it's portrayed that, you know, 95 people in the Crimea were in support of the referendum. We have to remember how referendum was executed. And I'm a little bit troubled by this idea that we are experiencing an outbreak of Cold War nostalgia. So I want to say, in fact, we finally distinguishing, we in the West, but also some people in the Petersburg Cafe, between politics of the state and the divided civil society and cultural heritage. It's not the same thing. I imagine in Petersburg Cafe there would be great despair about what's going on in Russia and about Putin's actions.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask, and maybe, Maxim, you're the one. How would the men in the cafe, the underground guys, be dealing with the chagrin and maybe embarrassment that this far out of the Soviet Union, they're still not a free people, even remotely, and that things are not working out politically?
Chris, I do not know how to answer your question, and I would rather not speculate. If I may, I'd like to invoke one more literary voice that is important to Crimea and also central to both Russian and American culture. You mentioned him before. It is Vladimir Nabokov, whom I know you admire.
I do.
Nabokov parted with Russia in Crimea as a young man. He spent the end of 1917, 1918 in Crimea. He sailed from Crimea.
An aristocrat who never forgave the revolution.
Into exile. But I want to mention a different thing. That is to say, Crimea certainly was of great interest, and he would have had a lot to say, invoking his spirit. But I want to mention that Nabokov set a very high plank in times of war and in times when Russia was at war and when a lot of rhetoric was in the air that appealed to the patriotic or to those who thought themselves as patriots. Even during the war, when Russia was fighting Nazism, Nabokov never failed to remind the world that this was a Stalinist dictatorship. And I think that perspective should probably enlighten us as we think of the Crimean intervention. And even if the Russian mainstream is intoxicated by the rhetoric of Crimea as Russia and by this bloodless quick war, it should also be rereading Nabokov to be reminded of the fact that it is a dictatorial move in a state that is inching its way toward being a dictatorship.
Have you answered my question about how people feel about sort of, shall we say, very, very slow progress? I mean, Nabokov wrote as if it was going to be over when the Soviets were over, if ever. He didn't live to see the day. But why are we stuck in this kind of sort of brute politics? Mark Kramer.
Well, you know, Putin, throughout his first two terms as president, often had popularity ratings of 75% to 80%. That was even as he was going about systematically dismantling the democratic gains that had been achieved in the 1990s. So, unfortunately, you know, that Russia had undergone an economic recovery that began in the late 90s, and then Putin came in and happened to benefit from it, as well as high world oil prices. So he was able to benefit from that, and people apparently were willing. People in Russia were apparently willing to go along with the destruction of any progress to a democracy. And that, again, is precisely what Putin has been doing since he came back for a third term in 2012. The phrase that Svetlana mentioned before, that fifth column of national traitors, that's in line with a whole series of steps that Putin has been undertaking to present those who protest, those who disagree with him, as just agents of the West.
Thank you all. Last word for me, it has the feeling more of a sort of gray Chekhovian tragedy than a kind of thundering Shakespearean or even Dostoevskian tragedy. And maybe Nabokov said this, maybe that's the better way. Thanks to Suzanne Massey, Mark Kramer, Maxime Schreier, also to Professor Svetlana Boehm and Sarah Faia at Harvard's Davis Center, and to the international book world in Brookline, Massachusetts. You can hear lots more of Suzanne Massey on our website at radioopensource.org. You can join our discussion, too, about reading Russia. You can also find the second part of our long conversation with the man of so many musics, Gunter Schuller. We're going out on a Russian musical piece called The Sevastopol Waltz, which was played at a rally and concert this week, where Putin appeared. He told the crowd after a long, hard, and exhaustive journey at sea, Crimea and Sevastopol are returning to their home harbor, to the home port, to Russia. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. Севастопольский вальс помнят все моряки. Разве можно забыть мне вас?